Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 2, Regulatory and Examination Priorities for Private Fund Advisors. Timothy Levin and Jennifer Klass will discuss recent trends in the SEC examination process, as well as current and important regulatory and inspection priorities for private fund advisors in the hedge fund industry. Now, on to the podcast.
First topic here is a look at the current SEC examination focus areas. I think a lot of this remains pretty consistent with past years, Jen, but maybe talk a little bit about what we're seeing from the staff in this.
I agree. I think a lot of this is consistent with themes that you've probably heard from us in the past. It's worth noting a couple of reminders, I guess, with respect to these areas of focus. The first is the SEC continues to work with and examine never-before-examined investment advisors. And these are advisors that essentially either are new registrants or have not been examined within an extended period of time, usually 5 to 10 years. And this started as a much smaller initiative. I think the staff has expanded it over time because they've found some interesting things with respect to this universe of advisors. And it's also a way to allocate sort of scarce resources by focusing on advisors who haven't yet been examined.
Yeah, and in the area of private fund advisors specifically, I think following Dodd-Frank, when all of the private fund advisors had to register for the first time, the SEC examination staff seems to be getting more up to speed on understanding the private fund business to a greater extent. And so we've seen some focus on some slightly more narrow issues that arise in the private fund space.
I think that's right. And also in different types of asset classes. As they've gotten more comfortable, they've begun to specialize and look at real estate, for example, and other more narrow asset classes. Some of the areas that they continue to focus on during these exams are conflicts of interest, and this was actually identified in the OC 2017 priorities list as an area of continued focus for private fund advisors. And the focus really is both on identifying conflicts and disclosing them, and in particular with respect to conflicts, focusing on areas where the advisor is taking action that are disadvantaging investors, or where there's some sort of undisclosed financial interest that benefits the advisor. And an additional area where there's continued focus on conflicts is in the allocation of investment opportunities, as well as fees and expenses. Again, those are consistent themes that the staff has been focused on for the last several years.
I think one thing we can point out about allocation of expenses and fees is perhaps the good news is that where we've seen examination lead to referrals to enforcement have not necessarily related to the commercial substance of the fee arrangements, but tend to relate more to disclosures of conflicts that arise from those things and whether the actual fee expenses and allocation methodologies are consistent with the fund documents. So there still is a recognition, I think, that in the private fund area, there are an infinite variety of permissible fee and expense allocation arrangements that can be had.
Yep, no, I agree with that. I think that's also true with respect to the allocation of investment opportunities. The staff hasn't mandated a particular methodology that's required. Rather, they've focused on situations where the allocation methodology deviates from what's disclosed to investors.
Yep. Cross trades is another area of examination focus. So one interesting thing about cross trades is that particularly, I should say, on the registered fund side, where we've seen some focus on this, we've heard the staff talk about their focus on big data and information gathering, setting fairly broad definitions of cross-trades and then taking a closer look at those cross-trades. And so for managers who regularly engage in cross-trades, it's going to be very important to make sure that you've got your policies and your procedures and appropriate disclosure about those types of transactions. It can be particularly difficult in the fixed income area where you often have to interposition a dealer in order to affect a cross trade that you might conclude is in the best interest of both sides of the trade, but you have to be very careful in the way you do it, and also be very mindful of whether you're looking at a cross trade between two clients that are simply advisory clients as opposed to ERISA clients, as there are special rules that apply and restrictions if you're doing this for ERISA clients.
I think the other thing just to note quickly on cross trades is to be focused on inadvertent cross trades. That is, two trades that appear to be a cross trade because they're sent to the market at the same time or sent to the same broker. One of the things the staff is using is their big data capabilities to essentially look through trade blotters and match or attempt to match trades that are with respect to the same security, same amount, opposite sides of the market. And the other thing just to be mindful of is that a cross trade that involves a related account, a proprietary account, or an account of an employee of the investment advisor then becomes a principal trade. And so be very mindful of that situation as well.
Yeah, this is definitely an area where it's easy to get tripped up if you're affecting a lot of cross trades.
Right.
Another area of focus is investment advisor custody. This is one that has been a focus for a number of years, although what's perhaps new is that there's some recent staff guidance in this area. The basic test for custody is whether the investment advisor has authority to obtain possession or control of the client assets. And very often, we'll focus primarily on what are the authorities that are granted to the investment advisor pursuant to the investment management agreement. The SEC staff pointed out that simply looking at the investment management agreement and restrictions on the advisor's ability to obtain custody of client assets under the management agreement isn't really sufficient if the client assets are being held at a third-party custodian, but the custodian agreement gives very broad authority to the advisor or specific personnel of the advisor to essentially direct the custodian to send assets anyplace. I mean, I think we typically think of a good safeguard in this area as making sure that the custodian arrangement reflects a what we call a DVP arrangement, a delivery versus payment, so that any asset that is sent out of the custody account is sent in exchange for receipt of another asset. The issue that the staff pointed out, however, is that while that's the way we generally will conceptualize a custody arrangement, the agreements themselves don't necessarily restrict the custodian to affecting transactions that are delivery versus payment, and the custodian, in fact, can act on any instruction that is received that it believes from an authorized person to instruct the custodian. And so the staff is pointing out that it really is important to align the authority under the management agreement with the authority that's actually conferred under the custodian agreement. I think what we're seeing is that for a lot of advisors, going back and taking a look at those custodial arrangements is going to be important, and it's going to be probably necessary in a lot of cases to tighten the authority that's granted under the custodian agreements.
Great. And there's also on the other side a lot of discussion currently with respect to the custodians in terms of ensuring that they understand the implications of that broad authority. Another perennial favorite is marketing. We just mentioned that because marketing and advertising continues to be on the list of hot topics. And then last but not least, fintech. So this is relevant to the extent that there are firms out there that are relying on quantitative-based strategies. Just to note that one of the fallouts or implications of the SEC's current focus on robo-advisors and fintech is that they're very focused on the compliance programs that advisors that use quantitative models or algorithms are developing and ensuring that those compliance programs adequately address the technology and other controls that are necessary around the development of the models, changes to the models, testing before the models are implemented, the downstream effects of the models, and lastly, disclosure about the limitations and assumptions incorporated into those models.
And Jen, I don't know what your observations are in this area, but there is some enforcement guidance in this area that goes back to more traditional quantitative investment managers and issues that have arisen when there's been an error in the model that's been discovered and how that has to be handled. I assume that's maybe a good reference point for looking at the way the SEC would view robo-advisors and the services the robo-advisors provide?
I think that's the Axa Rosenberg case from a number of years ago, and I think that is worth looking at. The interesting thing about that case, though, wasn't that there was a change in the model so much as the fact that there was effectively an attempt to cover up or minimize the impact of that change. And so the SEC looks at that really as a lesson with respect to how you address an issue if you're not going to, the cover up, really, as opposed to the actual controls. I think one thing you should really be focusing on is the controls. I think the SEC acknowledges and understands that there are going to be changes to models over time. There are going to be glitches in the system that can cause downstream effects with respect to the securities that are purchased or sold for client accounts. What they're focused on is, do you have a system in place that's reasonably designed to identify those issues and correct them? The next slide we put in here, just to highlight this, you know, the OC published in February of this year a risk alert that identified the most frequent compliance topics. And these are hardly things that are very unique or earth-shattering, but I think it's worthwhile to just focus on these things as reminders of the fact that the SEC continues to look for really the nuts and bolts technical compliance with things like, do you have written policies and procedures in place with respect to the compliance rule? Are you filing your Form ADV updates and other regulatory filings on time? Do you understand what it means to have custody? And are you aware of the circumstances under which the advisor would be deemed to have custody? Are you complying with the technical requirements of the Code of Ethics rules in terms of getting, you know, quarterly reports, annual certifications, et cetera? And lastly, does the firm have an appropriate process in place to both identify and retain the required books and records?
And I think standing alone, you look at many of these things and you could think of them as foot faults if you're not doing them exactly right. But the OC staff come in and they take a very detailed look at these things. And they do point out even the foot faults and they expect that you are going to correct the foot faults and cease the foot faults going forward. And I think also, while each one of these doesn't seem that significant standing on its own, you can definitely have a cumulative effect of seemingly not significant compliance issues that will, at the very least, change the view that OC has overall of your culture of compliance at your firm.
Right. And that concept of multiple compliance failures can ultimately either be a basis for a referral to enforcement or, more commonly, is, to Tim's point, something that will undermine the confidence that the staff has in the compliance program and culture of the firm. And so better to have these things taken care of than to have them work against you in the course of an SEC exam.
So, Jen, how about a quick discussion of some recent regulatory developments?
Sure. Well, I guess everybody knows that we have a new SEC chair. And so in addition to the new chair, we have a number of senior positions at the SEC, both on the enforcement and the policymaking side, that are being filled and reinforced. And so it will be interesting to see the direction that this SEC takes with respect to rulemaking in particular and regulation. I think we largely anticipate that the OC examination program will continue somewhat unaffected. I think that the SEC over time has developed these very broad initiatives, particularly in the asset management space, and we don't really see that abating on the examination side. I do think there's an expectation that the pace of rulemaking will slow and that there will be more focus on the economic impact and the staff being able to justify any new rulemaking that it engages in. A couple of other things that have come out that are just worth a mention. The first is participating affiliate guidance. I think a lot of private fund advisors, particularly advisors who have non-US affiliates, rely on the so-called participating affiliate guidance, which comes from the Unibanco line of new action letters that the SEC has promulgated over the years. And the concept here really is that a non-US affiliate of a US registered advisor doesn't itself need to register as an SEC investment advisor so long as certain conditions are satisfied. And the concept of a participating affiliate effectively means that this non-US affiliate can be involved in providing investment advice indirectly through their US affiliate to US clients, so long as certain conditions are satisfied. And all this guidance does, it doesn't disrupt the substantive guidance with respect to participating affiliate arrangements, but it does focus on the technicalities of how you perfect that reliance. And so it goes through a laundry list of representations that the staff is looking for firms who are relying on this guidance to make in writing with respect to things like service of process in the US, an undertaking that your affiliate will provide requested books and records, and also that you'll submit, the foreign affiliate will submit to the jurisdiction of the SEC, those sorts of things. One of the core provisions of the participating affiliate guidance and the Unibanco line of no action letters, however, is that the non-US advisor is not subject to the substantive requirements of the Advisors Act with respect to its non-US clients. Essentially, the SEC is just looking for oversight over the activities it's performing with respect to the US piece of this. And so this is the so-called sort of regulation light regime. I point that out because the other thing that's relevant on this slide are some amendments that were made to Form ADV Part 1 that go into effect in October of this year. And these amendments really affect separately managed accounts and are designed to solicit more information about separately managed accounts. But one of the key provisions that the amendments also included related to umbrella registration. And essentially, this is not the participating affiliate regime, but the relying advisor regime. And the concept that if you have multiple investment advisors who are engaged in the same business, that not all of them have to file an individual Form ADV. They all have to be eligible to be registered with the SEC, but you can designate a primary filing investment advisor, and then all of the other entities can effectively rely on that Form ADV. And I guess it's worth noting that the SEC essentially codified the guidance that it had given to the ABA in 2012 with respect to this matter. But one of the significant changes that they made was to clarify that the filing advisor had to be a U.S. investment advisor, meaning that it has its principal place of business in the United States. And to the extent that you have other investment advisors, including non-U.S. advisors, relying on that primary filing, those non-U.S. advisors can't rely on the regulation light regime. So they're subject to SEC jurisdiction with respect to all of their U.S. and non-U.S. clients.
Which I think makes it pretty difficult to make the determination, if you're an advisor, that the benefit of the relying advisor regime is so great that you'd forego the ability for your non-U.S. advisor to not have to comply with the Advisors Act with respect to its non-U.S. clients.
Exactly.
So it seems to really undercut the effectiveness of that filing efficiency.
That's right. And so it's something that it's worth making sure you understand if you have a relying advisor regime, because I think you really are giving up a significant amount of flexibility with respect to the non-U.S. advisors.
Yeah. Just the other thing to point out about the participating affiliate guidance is that the participating affiliate concept and the Unibanco letters are really quite complex in the way that the fact patterns in those letters evolved over time, and it is not always easy to determine exactly what law applies in what situation to a given client. We are seeing, as Jen said, there hasn't been any substantive change to the guidance in those letters, but this participating affiliate guidance and our own experience with examinations of multinational advisors is that the staff is focusing on this, and it's entirely possible that in the context of an examination, determinations that are made by the advisor in interpreting the participating affiliate rules get second-guessed by the staff. And so this is another reason to make sure that you are appropriately documenting the arrangements that you have between your U.S. and non-U.S. affiliates.
And to consider potentially documenting the analysis that you've gone through to conclude that you're able to rely on that line of no action letters.
Yeah. So Jen, potential legislation here, the Financial Choice Act. I think at the time that we prepared the slides here that this was proposed legislation. It's recently passed by the House.
That's right.
You want to provide a quick update on where this stands and some key features?
Sure. So last Thursday, the House passed the Financial Choice Act. And essentially, what it's designed to do at a high level is to roll back many of the Dodd-Frank requirements that affect investment advisors and other financial services companies and really pull back on those reforms. One of the key provisions of the Financial Choice Act was the elimination of the Volcker Rule. There's also a proposal incorporated in there to eliminate the DOL fiduciary rule, which would make, I think, everybody happy, except for our ERISA colleagues. And there were a number of other provisions that are incorporated into the Choice Act that were designed to provide flexibility, particularly with respect to private equity fund advisors and venture capital fund advisors. I think this is really an attempt to acknowledge that even though those advisors were pulled into registration as a result of Dodd-Frank, that they don't look like all of the other investment advisors that are registered and regulated by the Advisors Act, and therefore to provide some flexibility. Whether or not that will actually come to be, I think, is an open question. At this point, it doesn't appear that there's significant support in the Senate to pass the act as it's currently configured. It may be that there are pieces of this legislation that are pulled out and acted upon, but I think that that is a broader question in terms of the current political environment, and one that actually our partner, Chris Cox, will be addressing at lunch.
We will be asking that very question.
Yeah, and I think he's in a far better position to answer it than I am. But I think it is something that's worthwhile to continue to keep an eye on to see what the themes are that are incorporated into this legislation and what flexibility they potentially would provide to private fund advisors.
Okay. Well, I see we're just about right on time here. And thank you, Jen. And thank you all. Jen and I will be here. I think I'll be here all day. And I look forward to speaking to anybody who has some follow-up questions.
Thanks very much.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.